already discussed this. I don't want to take any more people.
We need the money.
Yes, I know, but one more person isn't going to make any difference.
Why was I told my Aunt Rita was dead?
Isn't she?
It was all before my time.
There was someone in the house.
Well, if you like, I'll report it.
Your mother couldn't cope, Linda, because your aunt was a very sick woman. Finally, she had to be sent to a home, and that's where she died.
Linda, it's Mr. Collins. He's dead. Died in his bar. Lance found him.
Hey, shh. It's me, okay? It's only me.
I don't know what's happening. There was somebody in the bathroom.
You remember my Aunt Rita.
When did she die?
Adrian King, Alice from Friday the 13th, and the hysteria continues.
And indeed it does. Welcome back to The Hysteria Continues, episode 190. And this time we're going down under, not going down as Eric would, but down under to the land of wallabies and kangaroos and koalas and serial murders in next
akin.
And Alan Dale, yes, of course. The Next of Kin from 1982. Just off the top of the show, Nathan isn't able to join us today, but he will be back on the next episode. So hopefully we'll be hearing his thoughts on Next of Kin next time. But this is Joseph's pick. So how are you doing, Joseph?
Quite well. How about yourself?
Not too bad. I've got a little bit of a cold, but can't complain. Yeah. So,
too bad.
Yeah, well, it's just one of those things. Since I've been out here, I haven't had a cold in a year, and I just kind of got a bit of a minor sniffle. So it's nothing to write home about at all. But Eric, are you fighting fit?
I was just in the middle of writing home about your cold, actually.
So. Okay, well, that's good. Yes, yeah, so don't worry. Don't send any posies or any chocolates or anything like that. I'll be fine.
Posies? I haven't heard that word in a long time.
I know. I'm a Victorian child.
Yes.
So, yes, we are covering Next of Kin coming up a little bit later for the Australian slasher movie, or kind of slasher movie. We can discuss how much of a slasher movie it is a little bit later. Before we do that, we haven't actually recorded for a little while. We've had a bank of episodes we've had because we've had various holidays and various things. So we haven't actually been together for a few weeks. So I'd be curious to see what you've been watching recently. So I'll start with you, Joseph. Have you seen anything of note?
Yeah, I went to the theater and saw Ma. It's M-A, as in my ma. I had it in my mind that this was a From Hell type thriller, and the whole time I'm thinking, why would a recent Oscar winner like Octavia Spencer, you know, bless her heart anyway for doing it, why would she do, you know, a silly From Hell film? So I was kind of curious going in, and that's because it seems like a From Hell film, but there's a pretty... well, I can't really spoil it, but there's a bit of a bait and switch going on. It's a very interesting movie about this woman who starts hanging out with these teenagers and letting them party at her house, and she buys them alcohol, and she just gets a little too close and friendly with them, and a lot of the thrills are derived from that. But like I said, there's a few twists and turns in the story. Well acted, very, very well shot. Very entertaining. Not exactly what I expected. More thoughtful than I expected, honestly. But I did enjoy it. So thumbs up.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard good things about it. So, but it's not one I've caught. It's not come out here yet, and it's certainly not in English language anyway. What about you, Eric? Have you had a chance to see it yet?
No, I've been away as well, so I haven't seen it. I have heard good things. Actually, there's a couple of things in the cinema that are getting good reviews that I would like to see, but we'll probably have to wait for home viewing, I would say.
Okay, right. Okay, well, that's one to look out for. Anything else, Joseph?
Yes, I know you watched it as well. I watched the third season of Slasher. What was this one called again? I can't remember. Slasher Solstice.
Yeah.
It's basically about a bunch of people in an apartment complex getting picked off one by one. And right off the bat, these are some of the most graphic murders I've ever seen on anything. I mean, in the second episode, or it may have been the first, I can't remember, but there's a decapitation that just made my stomach turn almost. It was so, you know, just graphic and brutal. I think I preferred the second season a little better. I think it's a little more, coherent. This one's kind of all over the place. There's so many characters and so many subplots that's kind of hard to keep track of. But the slasher stuff, like I said, is just so, so good. It's just so, well done. I liked a lot of the characters are just kind of snotty, but they're not obnoxiously snotty. They're just kind of comically snotty. I love the blogger girl. I really wanted her to kind of be the main focus of the show. I loved her so much, but unfortunately she's not. But still, I had some fun with it. It kind of falls apart a little bit in the second half. And I did guess who the murderer was fairly early on, but it was still fun, still a lot better than that first season. What did you think?
Eric, have you seen it?
No, I haven't, no.
No, okay. I started off really enjoying it, and I kind of agree, it kind of fell apart a little bit. Although all the clues were there about who the killer was, and the motivation was kind of sound to some degree, it was a little bit too over the top. I mean, it's strange to say that it could have used a bit of restraint, but I do think it probably could have done, actually. It just felt a little bit too over the top for me.
For me, it felt almost like the first half of the season was kind of fun and almost fluffy, and then it kind of got depressing as it went on. Did you pick up on that at all?
Yeah. And also, I kind of like the I think the idea of doing so, setting a whole series of murders over 24 hours was a good idea. But it kind of meant it kind of also kind of handicapped the show a little bit, because it meant they had to do certain things that if it had more room to breathe, it might have worked a little bit better.
Another problem I had with it is that this, I love stuff that deals with, like, you know, time travel and stuff, but this had so many like flashbacks, and it kept jumping back and forward in time. It would even do like flashbacks to characters who had been dead a long time, and you'd kind of forgotten who they were. Mm. It was kind of, it just kind of got too muddled, I think, story wise.
Yeah. But if you are a fan of slash movies, and if you're listening to this, you probably are, I would definitely recommend watching it. You know, it's very entertaining. I think the second series overall worked a little bit better. And interestingly, I mean, it's Canadian made, isn't it? But of the actors and actresses in this have been in the other, some of the other ones as well. So it's a bit of an ensemble cast to some degree.
It's kind of like American Horror Story. They just keep using the same actors in different stories, but they're all slasher stories, which is what I like. But I am looking forward to, I kind of lost interest in American Horror Story after the first or second season, but I am kind of looking forward to 1984, the slasher one that's coming out.
Yeah, I am as well. I mean, I'd be very surprised if they do a kind of straight ahead slasher story, though. I'm sure there's going to be some kind of twist.
Yeah.
It's not going to be.
I'm a little worried it might be kind of they may bounce off that as like a joke into something else, and it just won't be as effective. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, because every episode of or every series of American Horror Story I've seen, and I haven't actually seen that many, but it always veers off. It's a bit of a glutton in a sweet shop, isn't it? It's everything but the kitchen sink's thrown in. So I'd be very surprised if they do like a however many 15 episode series season just based on a camp slasher, but it remains to be seen.
It's usually 13, I think, 13 to 15 episodes. That's one of the reasons why I like slasher, because it's only 8 episodes, so it's over pretty quick, you know. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Okay, well, thank you, Joseph. Anything else?
One more thing. I have to mention this because I have a friend on Instagram who she lives in Las Vegas, and she's like obsessed with the Marvel Comic Universe films. And, you know, I'm always ragging on these films. So she kind of took me to task and told me to watch. We made a deal. I would watch all these movies if she would watch the same amount of slasher films that I picked, because she had never seen a slasher film except for one of the the Friday the 13th films, and I don't even remember which one it was. But anyway, I agreed. So I've watched like seven of these damn movies. And shockingly enough, I'm not going to get into this too much, but shockingly enough, I haven't really disliked any of them except one. I've actually kind of enjoyed most of them, and I've actually loved two of them. So there's your progress report. I don't think I'll ever watch them again, but hey, I guess they're okay for what they are. But I am interested to see what you're going to say about the slasher films I picked, because I know you're listening to this episode, because I'm going to make you listen to this episode. So
have you assigned her any Nathan type movies to watch?
I'm going to give her the mainstream stuff. Some of the stuff I like. I might throw in a couple of the goofier ones, like A New Beginning or something.
Well, I'm glad to hear you haven't become completely mind-washed by the superhero movies.
No.
That would be very strange.
Like I said, there's two of these movies that I really liked. The first one was Thor. The first Thor, I thought it was just an overall fantastic film, even if it was a comic book film. And I liked The Avengers and Iron Man. The rest of them, I just kind of tolerated.
Ant-Man, the Ant-Man movies?
No, I'm watching these in like a chronological order. Right.
Ant-Man is very far down the list, yeah.
I got like three or four more movies before I get to that, but I am actually kind of looking forward to the Ant-Man films, because I mean who doesn't like Paul Rudd? He's just a great guy,
and he's a great Michael Myers hunter.
Yes,
we're turning into a superhero podcast here, but I did see Ant-Man when it came out, and I did enjoy it. I thought it was one of the best of them, because it had a real sense of humor and it had a goofiness to it that I thought was lacking in a lot of the other ones, which take themselves a bit too seriously.
Mm. No, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to that one.
And isn't Paul Rudd, I think we discussed this before, but isn't he a big fan of 80s slasher movies?
I believe I heard along those lines.
Yay. So if you're listening, Paul, and want to come on the show to discuss them, then you'd be more than welcome. So,
yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, Joseph. Anything else?
I feel like there probably is, but that's all I can really remember. It's still early.
Okay. No problem. Thank you. Eric, how about you?
Okay. Well, really only two to talk about. One, I did go to the cinema as well. I went to see Godzilla, King of the Monsters, which was possibly one of the worst summer blockbuster movies I've seen in a very long time. It's the reviews of it are quite Marmite-y. Some people are really liking it. Some people are really hating it. I'm on the hating side, I'm afraid. I just found it so mind-numbingly boring, and it's 130 minutes. I mean, the accusations made at Gareth Edwards' 2014 movie Godzilla, to which this is a sequel, was that there wasn't enough monster mayhem. But with this, the pendulum swings completely in the opposite direction, and it's just non-stop monster mayhem for 130 minutes, and it just gets tedious. I remember you were discussing The Nun when you saw it last year, Justin. You said that the problem with the film was that there was probably too much going on in it, and that it just becomes a bit repetitive and dull. And this is exactly what happens in Godzilla King of the Monsters for me. I mean, it features Godzilla and Mothra and a few other monsters from the classic movies of the 60s and 50s and that, whose names I can't remember, but it's virtually plotless, and it has them just constantly fighting in thunderstorms, and it's edited in the same way as like a Transformers movie. So you've got this strobing light effect from the lightning that's happening. The editing is so frenetic that you just can't make out anything that's going on. You get these occasional interludes where it cuts to the human characters. I knew nothing about the film going into it, and as I was sitting in the seat waiting for the lights to go down, I looked on IMDb to see who was in the film, and the first three cast members listed were sort of a middle-aged woman, a middle-aged man, and a teenager. And I just turned to my flatmate, who I went to the cinema with, and said, I bet you anything that those two are a couple who are now estranged, but they find love again, in adversity while searching for their teenage daughter who's, on the run from the monsters. And that's exactly what happens in the film. It's exactly it, word for word. I just found it horrendously boring. It's a shame, because I didn't go into it expecting it to be boring. I thought it would be kind of, fun, because I like monsters. And I think Cloverfield, for example, did giant monsters attacking a city really well. And I thought, surely they can't mess this up. But they did. I thought it was horrendous from start to finish, and I couldn't wait to get out of there. And I'm sure there was probably some end credit sequence that a lot of people hung around for, because the lights stayed down as the credits were rolling, but I just got out of there. I just wanted to get home. I hated it.
So is it one you're going to get on Blu-ray?
Possibly not. However, On the flip side, the same week, I did finally catch up with Us, which is the new Jordan Peele movie. Well, not the new, the latest Jordan Peele movie. I mean, I'm late to the game, I know, on this one, because I know you've seen it, Joseph. And I loved it. I really loved it. I said earlier to you guys that I accidentally read a review online that I thought gave away the ending, but it wasn't as big a spoiler as I thought when I'd read it, because there was still plenty of surprises in the film. I found it to be, you know, intriguing and gripping and utterly ludicrous, which I wasn't expecting. It reminded me very much of an M. Night Shyamalan movie, and that's kind of praise from me, because I love the concepts behind his movies. I love really just ludicrous ideas, I suppose, and there's a ludicrous idea at the center of Us that I just love. I'm surprised maybe critics didn't sort of, you know, pick on that a bit more. I'm not sure why, but I thought it was quite Twilight Zone-y, which I loved, and I know it's pushing 2 hours, and it might be over 2 hours, but I didn't it never got boring or dull for me, and it you know, unlike Godzilla, King of the Monsters, it starts out slow and builds and builds and builds. And so it kept me entertained. I preferred it to Get Out. And I found it, as I said, thoroughly entertaining from start to finish. It was lived up to the hype this time, I found.
Hmm. Yeah, it has a really good sense of humor to it as well. And it's also, you know, a lot more of a slasher film than Get Out was.
Yeah, exactly.
I caught up with it as well.
All right, what did you think?
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it as well. I was surprised, actually. I remember being slightly underwhelmed with Get Out, and it was a little bit puzzled by why it got this massive amount of praise. And I did wonder if when I read the reviews, and it was glowing reviews about Us, and I was surprised, like you, about how silly it was. And that's not a criticism. I was surprised how much fun it was, because I thought that he'd make a slightly more po-faced movie and maybe listen to his own hype and everyone saying he was the next, you know, greatest director since John Carpenter or whatever. So I thought he'd make quite a po-faced movie, but in fact, actually, he made far more playful bizarre kind of movie, which is very much more like it was a slasher movie to some degree. So that surprised me. I didn't see the major twist. Which I won't spoil, I didn't see coming until towards the end of the movie. But yes, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. And I was, like you, I was surprised with the critics being so universally acclaiming it. And I did wonder if they were all slightly worried if they kind of slagged it off, they might be, you know, I didn't really know what I was letting myself into when I went into it. But it reminded me a little bit of that film, The Invitation, the one when there's the party. And those people turn up and start killing the guests, and then they realize it's happening right across Los Angeles, across Hollywood.
Yeah, it has sort of that same tone. Similar story as well, not totally similar, but, you know, flourishes.
Yeah, I mean, this is more of a kind of fantasy movie, wasn't it, in some ways? I mean, yeah. I really liked it. I'm looking forward to watching it again. Now I know what, you know, I was kind of, what the actual tone of the film was, because I was started watching it and I'm thinking, you know, I'm not sure where this is going to go. But it's a kind of recommend from me.
Yeah, because tonally, for me, it reminded me, as I said, of M. Night Shyamalan movies, like the ones that were really slagged off, like The Happening, which I know is a bad movie in it, and the acting in it is appalling, which is a cue for you, Joseph, to do your line.
Well, I might as well do it now, because I've actually got background on Next of Kin, so what? No.
Yeah, and it reminded me, like, things like The Village, which were, you know, the critics just poured scorn on them, and I liked both of those movies. I saw sort of similarities in Us, in terms of its plot.
You know, what's interesting that you mentioned about M. Night Shyamalan is that a lot of people are comparing Jordan Peele to being the next, you know, M. Night Shyamalan, and, you know, they're saying they're hoping he doesn't take the path that he did. You know how, like, in the beginning, M. Night Shyamalan was, like, you know, heaped praise because of The Sixth Sense, and then when Unbreakable came out, everyone was like, it's a good movie, it just doesn't live up to the Sixth Sense. Now, I'm saying the same thing about, you know, Get Out and Us as I am about Sixth Sense and Unbreakable, is that they are similar in that, you know, directorial kind of way, but I preferred Unbreakable over The Sixth Sense, like I prefer Us over Get Out. And the mainstream majority opinion is the opposite. It's kind of interesting that you brought that up.
But that is all I have seen.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, apart from Us, a couple of other things I saw recently. One was a film called Monster Party, which isn't the kind of Godzilla-style monsters, but it's it was kind of similar in some ways to, is it, which is the one where the teens break into the house? And
Strangers?
No, the ones where they break in, Don't Breathe, that was it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we've got this sort of teenagers, it's a kind of similar kind of thing, but it's kind of quite a cool concept. It's these three teenagers kind of get this gig waitressing at this exclusive party, which turns out to be a gathering of reformed serial killers who meet every year to celebrate their kind of inverted commas sobriety. I'm not celebrating having not killed anyone. And these three teenagers are there to rob the person who owns the house. And predictably, things go south very quickly. So it's quite a cool concept. It veers like Us, or much more than Us, actually. It veers into comic book territory very quickly, in so much it goes very, very over the top, and is very, very gory, with lots of you know, people heads split in half and all sorts of things. But it's kind of, it's a relatively, not big budget, but medium budget movie. It looks great, but it's one of those movies that by the end it's gone a little bit too over the top and becomes a bit silly. But it was pretty tense and quite entertaining for its first half. Have either of you heard of that or seen it?
No,
I've never even heard of it. It kind of sounds fun, though.
Yeah, it's got Robin Tunney. She's the kind of matriarch of this kind of this dysfunctional family, and Julian McMahon, who was in, is the Australian actor who's in quite a few, he's in Nip Tuck, and so there's a few kind of recognisable faces in it. It's definitely worth a watch, but it's a little bit over the top, a little bit too silly. But it's one of those films when you see it gripped me in the first half, and then I kind of get less, I guess, if you let yourself go along for the ride in the second half, then you know, again, it's one of those films where the tone kind of shifts a little bit,
if it gripped you at the bottom but didn't quite make it to the top.
Well, exactly. Oh, Joseph. So well, the second thing I was going to mention very quickly is something completely different. This is a film that I've seen on Netflix advertising. Well, it's been sitting on Netflix for best part of a year, I kind of guess, and I've been tempted by it, but I was put off a little bit by its bloated running time. It was Gareth Evans, Apostle, with Nathan's favourite Dan Stevens, who was, of course, in The Guest with Maker Monroe. Now, this is a very, very different type of movie. It's kind of set in the turn of the last century, sort of 1905, I think. And Dan Stevens plays this character whose sister has been kidnapped by this kind of religious order living on this very remote Scottish island, where they're building this religious kind of retreat. And he tricks his way in there to try and find out what's happened to her. So the premise is not bad, and it's got some great actors and people in it. It's got, I can't remember his name now, the name will come to me in a minute, but it's got quite a few recognisable faces in it. It's very well acted, beautifully shot. It's got an intriguing premise, but it goes on and on forever, and actually the payoff, it isn't a great, I just didn't enjoy it very much. It's one of those films where you know, when you start watching a film, you invest yourself in it, and when you start checking your phone, you know, it's kind of losing you, and it's one of those films that it just didn't work. Dan Stevens kind of plays his role like a kind of slightly bug-eyed silent film star, which is kind of like a slightly curious choice for what is supposedly the hero of the piece. But the central premise, the mystery of it all, doesn't really hold up to its kind of bloated running time. So it's a shame, really, because I was looking forward to it. It had that kind of Wicker Man vibe, but I didn't. It didn't grab me. I don't know.
Is Michael Sheen the actor?
Michael Sheen, that's what I was thinking of. Have you seen it?
I haven't, no. I hadn't even heard of it, but I'm just looking at, just listening to you there and reading the premise here on IMDb. It does sound Wicker Man-esque, which would entice me, but...
You might get more out of it than I did. I mean, also, I'm willing to, admit that I may not have just been in the right frame of mind for that kind of movie.
That exact phrase may come up later in this podcast.
Oh, okay. Well, is it time for... I mean, that's all I've seen of notes. So maybe we should head straight into Next of Kin and...
Fed Income.
So after the trailer, we'll come back with Joseph with the synopsis.
Bad movies. The world is full of them. From low-budget crap fests to downright unwatchable. And only two men are willing to watch them all. So climb in and take your seat. This is Short Bus Cinema.
Let's do it.
Hey everyone, this is Johnny Krug from Kruger Nation.
And this is Rick Morgan from the Helming Power Hour.
We have decided to team up and take you where no one has gone before.
We're on a quest to find the world's worst movie, and we're doing it on the bus.
Driving through cult classics in every genre to find holy grail of bad movies.
So if you're looking for something different and more fun than you can stand, then climb on in.
Short Bus Cinema is a proud member of Legion Podcasts.
That's right, yo!
Short Bus Cinema. We love to watch the movies you hate.
Survive the nightmare that threatens her sanity. Fans of gothic horror will not be disappointed.
Linda Stevens was sent away from the family estate as a child for reasons she cannot remember. 20 years later, her mother dies and Linda inherits the shadowy old mansion, now a retirement home. Immediately, the walls close in on her. Linda is plagued by garish nightmares, haunting memories, and stealthy, watchful eyes. Her sanity badly shaken, Linda turns to her mother's diaries for answers, where she finds a deathly mirror of events. Something evil is in this house, and it wants Linda dead. This stylish suspense thriller will shock you as Linda discovers the blood-soaked secrets of Montclair. That was from the Virgin Vision VHS of Next of Kin. Next of Kin is a film I had not seen until after the fall of the VHS video store. So I was kind of late to it. I'd heard a lot of good things about this movie. So going into it, I was curious to see if it would, be as good as everyone was saying. And this is kind of a movie where you're watching and you're not exactly with it. The story is kind of, let's just put this out here. It's very, very leisurely paced. I'll just say that. For me anyway, it wasn't all that engaging, but at the same time, there's always something going on in this film where there's like little noises or little
like camera flourishes that's telling you something is about to happen. You need to stick with this. You need to focus and pay attention because something's about to pop off any second now. So there's something outside of the plot that just kind of keeps you hooked until the third act of the film, where the film really becomes just kind of demented and it lets loose and quite scary in a lot of spots. Very, very, you know, atmospheric and chilling, very creepy. I really like the lead girl. I like John Jarrett as Barney. He looked so much different here than he did in Wolf Creek. I do have a lot more to say about it, but earlier in the week, Eric was telling us about some mixed feelings he had on the film. So do you care to elaborate on that, Eric?
Yes, well, like the adhesive used on many a popular brand of plaster, I had an odd reaction to Next of Kin. I'd never seen the film before, but I picked up, it came out on Blu-ray earlier this year in a number of territories, including the UK and Ireland, and I picked it up, but only got around to watching it this week. And I was watching it as I was on Facebook Messenger to you, which probably says that I wasn't exactly engrossed in the film on my first time watching it. Justin said there that, you know, maybe I just wasn't in the right frame of mind to watch it. And I think that is the case here because I sat down to watch it because I had to watch it for the podcast, not because I was in the mood to watch a movie. And maybe that sort of was influencing my opinion. But for that first half, I found the film way too slow. I found it quite cold and detached. And as I said, I was chatting to you guys on Facebook and I was saying like it was 47 minutes into the film and I just wasn't feeling it. I felt it was meh. And, you know, I'd read Justin's review on Hysteria Lives where he gave it a, high praise indeed. And I was like, I'm just not getting it. I don't understand where the hype is as such for this film. But then just as I said to you, in that message, I'm not feeling the movie, things start to happen. And, you know, it really kicked into gear, not in a high octane way, not in a Godzilla King of the Monsters way, thankfully. But, the setup from the first half really begins to pay off and you begin to, feel rewarded for sticking with the film. And I encourage anyone who's, not feeling the film for the first half to just stick with it because the second half really does, things do pick up. I've watched it sort of twice subsequently since Thursday night because there's two commentary tracks on the Blu-ray. I'm seeing like, okay, I missed this when I was watching it at first. And if I'd been paying attention rather than being on Messenger, maybe I would have, enjoyed it more because I thought it was a fine movie indeed. Very much a film of two halves, as I'm saying. It's not a popcorn movie by any stretch of the imagination. And it reminded me, in terms of its pacing, of something like House with the Laughing Windows, which is another film where my first time watching it, I was like, this is painfully slow. When is something going to happen? But on subsequent viewings, I think it's a bit of a masterpiece. And I think that could happen with me with Next of Kin the next time I sort of sit down to watch it when I'm actually in the mood to watch a slow burn horror film. So there's loads in the movie that's just worth pointing out. I love in the early parts. Sorry?
Did you say there's loads in the movie?
Oh, just Joseph.
What? Don't drag me into this.
It was force of habit going, oh, Justin. Sorry. How can loads be? You just find rudeness in any kind of word.
Well, it's a very, very common colloquialism over here in the States.
For what?
For cum.
Yeah, I know. But in Ireland, we use it as a quantifiable word.
Yeah.
There's loads of stuff. Okay, there's lots. Will I use that to say instead?
Yeah. Well, in Portugal, they use lots. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
So there's lots to like in the movie. I love those shots in the distance where we see somebody standing in the distance between a couple of trees and Linda's like, ooh, who's that? And it's kind of spooky. I love the picturesque setting. It's, like Friday the 13th, I think the sort of the isolation of where the house is set really adds to the mood and the atmosphere. The shot of the body in the bathtub, it brought to mind The Shining. And that guy was kind of hot, that dead body in the bathtub. Am I allowed to say that?
No.
No. Reading reviews online of the film, a lot of people point out that the film sort of is resonant of The Shining, I suppose, in the same way that Linda is inheriting this sort of rural nursing home. It's kind of like Jack Torrance inheriting, well, becoming the caretaker of the Overlook Hotel, which is in the middle of nowhere as well. But Next of Kin sort of plays its cards in a manner where it could turn into a Shining like supernatural movie. I mean, if an hour into the film it suddenly turned out there was ghosts in the, or something happening like that in the nursing home, it would have made sense, because it's like a sort of classic giallo from the 70s where you know, you think surely something supernatural is happening. This can't be, you know, happening in the real world. But so it could easily have taken a supernatural turn and it wouldn't have felt, you know, unnatural as such. I love there's a shot where Linda's looking out the window and she sees her friend Carol in a car and she's like, oh, what's Carol doing down there? And then the camera just pans slightly to the left and we see that Carol is lying there dead in the passenger seat. And I thought that was really creepy. As I said, the second half really picks up and you get tons of incredible camera work that Sam Raimi would have been proud of, including the stunning sequence of Linda running in slow motion down a corridor with the camera dollying overhead like something from The Evil Dead. And I thought that was incredible. So the second half of the film really won me over. To such an extent that it went from being a sort of a meh movie to a ooh movie, and that's high praise.
I like some of the scenes, like some of the scenes where like stuff, nothing really comes of the scene, but at the same time,
you said comes.
Yeah, I did. But at the same time, it's just the way they're shot. They're so creepy. Like the one scene where she goes in and the dead body is uncovered and it's just kind of staring at her. And then she turns around and she sees the old woman just kind of staring at her. And nothing really comes of the scene. But at the same time, it's just so kind of creepy for some reason. But Justin, what did you think of Next of Kin?
I haven't seen it for quite a while. And I remember I gave it a very glowing review on Hysteria Lives. I forgot it was such a slow burn to start off with. So I can see where you're coming from, Eric, with that, as it were. It very much is a film of two halves. I think because I've probably seen quite a lot of Australian cinema, it didn't surprise me. I thought it was interesting that it started off and it had that typical kind of Australian gruffness. When it started the film, it was that kind of small town. She goes, the main character goes into the petrol station kind of cafe, come diner. And it's very Australian. Everything is very Australian. You know, they're very kind of gruff and they're, you know, the most exciting thing they've happened, that they've got a new public toilet. So, but it's interesting the way as soon as it gets to Montclair, the retirement home, this kind of gothic retirement home, the whole film takes on a much more gothic tone. Everything is very un-Australian in a lot of ways. And I think that was definitely what the director was aiming for, certainly having listened to the commentaries, that he wanted to make a kind of European-style horror movie, which kind of kicked against the traditions or what was fashionable at the time in the American slash movie. It was interesting when you were sort of saying about the nods to The Shining, because without jumping ahead too much to behind the scenes, the commentary track with the director and the producer said that the Shining was in release or hadn't come out yet when they were filming, which suggests this was filmed late in 1980.
False. I have done some research and yeah, I can give you filming dates, and it was a year after The Shining was released.
So they're telling Porky Pies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, right, but they did say that in the commentary, didn't they?
They did.
Yes, but I suppose it's, you know, 40-odd years ago, isn't it? A few lapses of memory.
In fairness, they mightn't have seen The Shining at that stage because it would have been a relatively new film, I suppose, or whatever. But it had been over a year in release in the States.
Interesting. Okay. Because I know but of course, they're in Australia, and I know that The Shining, I think it came out in May or something of 1980 in the United States, and didn't come out until October in the UK. And back then, and we've spoken about this, is that we're fairly used to films coming out almost immediately worldwide to stop kind of piracy, I kind of guess online piracy. But back then, quite often films wouldn't come out for, you know, 6 months, a year after the American release. So anyway, just back to the film. So it kind of takes that veer into this kind of gothic feel, and everything, you know, it permeates kind of everything, and it has that kind of slow burn feel, which I don't mind. And I quite enjoy. I think once again, it's one of those films that if you revisit it and you kind of know what you're getting in the terms of pacing and things, it's something you can actually kind of enjoy that possibly a bit more. It was interesting that they, you know, the majority of the victims are older people because it's a retirement home. So there was a film that not many people have seen. It's quite a bit from the early 70s or mid 70s called Homebodies. And it was about a group of pensioners in an apartment block who start murdering people because they're going to knock it down. And it's a kind of different feel to that, but there's kind of having this kind of older, much older kind of characters being bumped off is very atypical for the kind of slash movie at the time, when of course the majority of the focus would be on sort of nubile female and to a less extent male flesh. So in this,
you could on that note, Justin, you could also compare this film to a Scream from 1981. It's an older cast and it's very deliberately paced, very, very different movies, but at the same time, very similar, like you were saying.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, with that one, obviously, it goes Scream 1981 very much kind of goes off onto that supernatural tangent. Whereas this, all the way through it, you're not quite sure whether or not this is a kind of there is a supernatural element to this, and it turns out there isn't. And I'm sure we'll kind of get to spoiling it in a little bit. But a few things I really liked about it. I thought the main character, the woman, I thought was quite engaging. She's quite an odd looking woman in so much, almost like bird like features. She just felt she kind of, there has a certain intensity to her, which I thought was quite interesting, very different from the majority of slasher movie heroines of the time. I kind of really like the stylistically. I mean, it's a beautifully shot movie. The use of slow motion in it was really, really well done, because it could have been quite intrusive, but it wasn't actually. It really emphasised and actually brought out elements of the shot. There's a scene where the first body is found in the bath, and it looks like he's sitting up in the bath in this slow motion, a bit like very much like The Shining, with the old woman in the bath in the hotel room sitting up in the bath. But it actually, when it pans away, it shows that he's been pulled out of the bath by a group of people from an overhead shot. So there was that, and the scene at the end, which I think is, you know, there's quite sort of bone chilling, is the, I know you mentioned, Eric, was that kind of overhead shot of her running out of the house in slow motion down the stairs and down this corridor with this overhead shot following her. I think I said at the time in my review, possibly, that it was, which I forgot to read, but it was kind of almost Argento-esque. And I wouldn't be surprised if the director, because he said he was going for a kind of European feel, and he was talking about Roger Vadim with his kind of vampire movies, French vampire movies, but I would imagine he'd seen a fair bit of Argento by that point as well. I didn't listen to all of the commentary. I don't know if he mentioned Argento in any of it, Eric.
He didn't, no, but he does mention that he's not a fan of horror films as such, so he may not have encountered Argento.
Okay. There were a couple of nods to the kind of the slasher movie. I mean, there were scenes like you mentioned, Eric, as well, about the kind of disembodied figures in the background. And there's one where she looks out the window and there's somebody standing in the rain, silhouetted, very much kind of felt like a nod to Halloween and Jamie Lee Curtis looking out at the flapping washing line. It was interesting. I think it has that intensity, and then it goes, it kind of builds up this violent crescendo at the end with the basically the film's one graphic gore effect, isn't it? Which kind of brings to mind the famous Tom Savini head being blown off scene in Maniac. Overall, I think it's a great film. It's a slow, deliberate film. And I think if you think back to some of the other kind of Australian slasher movies or kind of films that were kind of playing off what was going at the time, there weren't that many of them. But of course, the day after Halloween, the famous killer in the ice cream truck, which again is another.
Oh, God.
One of Nathan's favorites. He keeps threatening us with that one.
Yes, he does. And then you've got films like, I don't know if you've ever seen The Plumber. It's about a psychotic plumber who...
Oh, that movie is awesome, Eric. You've got to see that movie.
Yeah.
There's one Australian movie that I love. It's not a slasher, but it is Long Weekend, which I love.
Yeah.
And again, it's very slowly paced.
Well, there were very few.
Of course, there's Road Games as well.
Yes, Road Games. But they're all kind of atypical, aren't they? They didn't really, until they started making films like Blood Moon in like 1990 and Symphony of Terror, was it? I think there's a few Australian slash movies that had more of a nod to America, but they're very, you know, if you're watching an Australian genre film. Definitely. But yeah, Next of Kin, I'm really pleased that it's actually got this kind of renaissance and more people are seeing it, because I'm sure we'll talk about something in the background, but the film didn't really get much of a release at the time, which is a shame. But yeah, definitely, if you're in the mood for something a little bit different and you're willing to, have the patience for something slightly different to your typical Friday 13th or My Bloody Valentine or something like that, then this is definitely worth your time.
There's one scene at the end. Of course, we spoil these movies always, so fair warning. There's a scene where the final girl, she's standing behind a door. And the killer, well, there's technically two killers in this film. One of the killers is looking through the peephole in the door. And she does this downward swing with this needle, and it goes through the keyhole and stabs her in the eye. It's just really well shot the way they do it. But at the same time, I'm thinking, my God, how lucky are you to get to – how lucky can you be to actually nail that, you know – yes. The landing on that, you know, right on the first swing, is just crazy.
Mm.
I was trying my best not to make it sound all innuendo-ish so you guys couldn't laugh at me.
Well, should we
choosing my words carefully?
Yes, but it's always,
well, we have to with you around these days.
Well, should we who would like to give a synopsis of what the the reveal?
Well, it's basically from a lady who used to live in the house many years ago under a different name, I believe. She was sent away to an asylum, so she came back to the house and started killing people.
Well, with a wig on. She comes back with a wig. That's her disguise.
Yeah, and her son is helping her out as well. But it's kind of weird that the mystery, the slasher-style mystery, is kind of a almost third or fourth banana to some of the atmosphere. So there's not a lot of pop or bombasticity in the plot of this film. It's more about atmosphere and tension, I'd say.
But it's also the if I'm right in thinking that it's her aunt, isn't it, who was sent away?
Yeah, wasn't it her aunt, Eric?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
And was she kind of recreating? I kind of got the impression, I mean, I might be wrong, that she'd murdered people in the nursing home 20 years ago and was sent away to an asylum, was coming back and recreating those deaths, wasn't it? Because in the final girl's mother's journal, she was saying that they found this man dead in the bath, and it seemed to be recreating these murders.
Yeah, kind of like a copycat.
Yeah, and the film ends in this scene that it kind of mirrors the beginning, because it's one of those, it's a curious kind of stylistic choice, because the film starts with about 20 seconds or 30 seconds from the end of the film, which shows her all bloodied and bruised at this gas station. And then it does this flashback without actually explaining anything. And I kind of guess it just expects you to realize this is kind of the whole thing is then flashing back to what had happened before. But there's this great scene at the end where she's at this abandoned, but there's this gas station kind of cafe, and there's just this kind of 10-year-old boy there as well, who's also appears at the beginning of the film as well. And they're sat there, and for some reason she knows, I don't know quite why she knows, but she does know that the one remaining baddie, the son of the woman, who is incredibly sinister, isn't she, when she takes her wig off and her eyes, she's got this amazing kind of maniacal
totally
look.
Mrs. Voorhees.
Totally Miss Voorhees. But she's waiting for him to turn up, and he does, and he comes smashing through, drives a truck into the cafe, and this great slow motion scene of them running away from that, and the kid falling backwards off the chair, all in slow motion, and ends with his head being being blown off with a shotgun, not the kid, but the baddie. And the other slow motion bit, which I loved, was the bit where she stabs the woman, her aunt, through the door, and she's on the floor, and she's runs over her, and she'd knocked out the other baddie, and she's running away, and she's got this like a brunette Jan Brady in slow motion with her hair going backwards and forwards like a pendulum, and she's running out the door. And I kind of expected, it's in such slow motion, it almost seems like it takes 5 minutes for her to leave the bathroom to come out, but that tension there is so well done, because you keep on expecting either the son to jump into frame or the aunt to kind of sit up Michael Myers like in the background and start coming after her, neither of which happens. But those moments and that scene with her escaping the house and getting out are kind of like a masterclass in suspense and really, really well done. So if you are tempted to give up on the film, if you find it too much a slow burn, then certainly the scenes at the end of the film, have those, because it's those kind of rare moments in 80s slashers, which we talked about before, like films like The Scare Maker, the ending of that, where it's obviously a much sillier film, Girls Night Out, Scare Maker, but has those kind of, or Sleepaway Camp, where you have those moments at the end of the movies which have such a kind of impact, because they're so out of left field, or they're so kind of bizarre, or out of character for the rest of the film. And so for this film to be such a slow burn, and suddenly it just kicks into this kind of high octane but ironically slow motion the crescendo is definitely worth checking out if you've not seen it already.
Yeah, it's very unusually shot, and a lot of the shots, according to some of the background I got, were kind of serendipitous, like the end shot where they're driving away and there's the explosion and they turn to see the diners exploded. Now that originally they had intended to shoot that head on, but they'd messed up. They were going to turn away from the vehicle and then show the explosion, but they turned away halfway from the characters before the explosion, so it's kind of like they're reacting to the explosion, and it just works very well. Yeah, a lot of the shots are kind of like that, just where it's not focusing on an object in the foreground or the background, but it's kind of focusing on characters' reactions to these things that are happening. It's just very unusual camera work, very well done.
Well, should we get onto some backgrounds, seeing as we're at that kind of time?
What? No.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, I have a little bit this week, actually. Next of Kin was apparently filmed all over Australia and New Zealand, and in so many locations, rather, that it would take way too long to list them all here. Obviously filmed in Australia. I didn't know anything about New Zealand, but apparently a few locations in New Zealand for some piecemeal shots. This is one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite Australian films, apparently. He sung its praises on the Not Quite Hollywood documentary. I think he said 10 non-Hollywood films that he loved. It was in one of those. It won the, and forgive my pronunciation as always, the Clavel de Plata Dorada for Best Director at the Sitges Film Festival. I know, Eric, you attend that quite a bit, don't you?
Not the film festival, no.
Oh, okay.
It's more like the Dunes and the
Portly Gentlemen Festival they have there every May and September that I used to frequent, but not anymore.
Oh, I gotcha. Released on VHS in Australia by Roadshow Home Video, like I said earlier in the show, in the States on the Virgin Vision label. I remember seeing that, like I said before, I remember seeing that VHS a lot. I mean, it seems like it was in every video store before, you know, the video stores went kaput, and it's kind of interesting that I never picked it up until after, you know, we had no more video stores here. I had to kind of obtain it illegally a while back. I'm sad to say, because I couldn't find a VHS copy, and it was not out on DVD or Blu-ray at the time. But yeah, that's all the background I have on the film. You guys can fight over who goes next.
Okay.
Gladiator style.
Yeah. Who? Do you want to go next, Justin, or do you want me to, or?
I don't mind. I mean, I've probably got less. If you watched both, I only watched half of one commentary. Or listen.
Okay,
to
you go. One. You go first, then, and I'll tick off because I listen to that commentary as well. So.
Okay, right. Well, the film was AKA Hell House, and apparently had a working title of Before the Night Is Out. The film started, originally there was a script, I think from back in 1979, of a black comedy called Sticky Ends, as it were, which is about a group of caterers killing off people in a retirement home. And so they kept some elements from it, but it became not a black comedy, but very much more horror movie. Joseph, you touched on the fact that Quentin Tarantino really liked this movie, and apparently he was famous, I think, for doing screenings of his house of films that and buying up prints of films and showing to people. And apparently when he was making Kill Bill, he got the cast and the crew to come up to his house to watch Next to Kin. The film, I used to have it on VHS, and it's a pre-cert, so it obviously did get a release in the UK, a kind of legitimate release. And I know on the commentary, the director said that the film got caught up in a kind of legal wrangles and didn't get a cinema release in Australia or anywhere else, I don't think, which is a shame, because I'm sure it would have looked great on the big screen. And he said that he got like a bootleg release on VHS in the United States, but certainly got a legitimate release on pre-cert video, because I had the old tape at one point. It was shot in 50 days. Jackie Kerin, who's the lead in this, it was her only feature film. She did a lot of TV, and I think still doing bits and pieces today. But she was also in, probably along with most Australian actresses, in Prisoner Cell Block H at some point. So I'll leave Eric to talk about John Jarrett as Barney and his future roles, because I'm sure you can fill us in on that, as it were.
Okay, well, obviously, Joseph has already mentioned he went on to be the villain in the Wolf Creek movies. He was also in the killer crocodile movie Rogue. And as Quentin Tarantino, as we said, is a big fan of Next to Kin, he also landed a role in Django Unchained. The filming dates, this is what I've come up with. They said it was filmed under the 10BA scheme in Australia, which allowed tax concessions to filmmakers. You know, and that's... scheme only came into operation in June of 1981, and they mentioned on one of the commentary tracks it was filmed in the summer, and in another one it was filmed in the spring. And you know, in the southern hemisphere, that would place it somewhere filmed between maybe September and December of 1981. So that's why you know, The Shining, I reckon, had been out a good maybe year and a half by the time they filmed it. Not that I'm accusing them of plagiarizing, because I don't think there is that much similarity between the two films. Cinematographer Gary Hansen had previously worked in Harlequin, which is another Aussie classic horror movie. He sadly died in a helicopter crash along with the assistant cameraman on Next of Kin when they were filming a commercial in early August of 1982. And that was just a little over 2 weeks after the very famous incident, which similarly happened on the set of Twilight Zone, the movie. They wanted Vangelis to do the score. He was, you know, hot property at the time, because he'd just done Chariots of Fire, but he was unavailable. They were big fans of Tangerine Dream, so they hired their one-time member, Klaus Schulze, to do the score. While they were waiting for him to compose the music, they temp scored the film with some of his back catalogue, because he had a lot of electronic... instrumental music, you know, out there in the public domain. So when he delivered the score for the movie, the filmmakers were not happy with it, and they just asked, can we license some of your existing music and just use it as such? So they used the temp score that they went with. As you were saying, after the film was completed, the film company, who are called Filmco, got into financial difficulties, and the rights to the movie went into kind of a legal loophole and into kind of a void, which kind of prevented it from getting any kind of decent release either in Australia or internationally. But as you said, it did turn up on VHS in the UK, and I'm assuming it must have got one in America as well if Tarantino had seen it. Jackie Kerin, as you said, did a lot of TV after that. She's now a children's author, and she does a lot of spoken word appearances at like poetry festivals and things like that. She's on the second commentary track, actually, on the Blu-ray, which actually it's released by Second Sight on Region B, which is the UK and Ireland, but it has a Region A release as well from Severn, and which has the same extras as far as I can tell. And it's well worth picking up because there's actually tons of extras on that, including details of a deleted scene. Now, there's no actual footage of this deleted scene because it doesn't exist, but it's shown in a series of still images, which proves it was filmed but just wasn't used. And it goes like this. Rita stabs the screwdriver, wherever it is, through the keyhole, Linda does, but she misses Rita's eye, it turns out. Rita has not been killed. They meet up in the kitchen then later on, Rita, Linda, and Lance. Lance gets killed. There's a big fight sequence like Mrs. Voorhees and Alice in Friday the 13th, and Linda pours a pot of boiling jam on Rita's head, which causes the flesh to sort of peel off her face and that. And on the extras on the Blu-ray, you can see the makeup effects, and they're really actually quite good. It's very like Pamela Susan Shoup in Halloween 2, that kind of effect. And that we think that's the end of Rita. We think she's dead now. But then in the scene at the end where they're in the ute, or truck, as we would call it outside of Australia, when the camera pans around to see the exploding building, the building explodes. And then Rita sits up because she's in the back of the ute. And she looks like she's about to kill Linda and the boy who are in the car, but then they hit a bump in the road and she falls out, and that's the end of the movie. And that apparently was all filmed, because you can see still images and outtakes and that on the Blu-ray, which also has a great I love these features. I mean, it's kind of nerdy, but I love features where it goes back to the original locations and shows you what they look like now. So there's that feature on it as well, which I always find really interesting for some reason. I don't know why. But that is all of the... Yeah, that's all of the...
It always amazes me when they do these kind of elaborate scenes and then reshoot them for whatever reason. I wonder why. Did they say why they didn't use that scene?
No, they don't. They briefly mentioned it in the commentary track. I don't know if you got to that stage where Linda looks into the kitchen and is it Connie is the character's name. She's making the boiling jam on the stove. She can see her stirring it, and he says, "Oh, that, you know, that this scene had a particular resonance in an early version of the film where Linda pours the boiling jam on Rita." But I don't know why, because it maybe they thought it was a bit over the top, a bit too slashery.
Well, Eric, I think it probably is time for...
It's my joke of the week. It's so fantastic.
Okay, so there was a Central American remake of this film that was released recently. I don't know if you heard about it. It was called The Mexican. The Mexican. Mexican. Look, it was 5 to 11. We were about 5 minutes away from recording, and I realized I hadn't come up with a joke.
There we go.
Oh, Eric.
Cunt. Cunt.
That wasn't me, by the way.
Wow. I figured.
Oh, yeah, I could have blamed that.
You are!
Oh, Eric.
Okay, moving on.
Moving on, yes. We should, like, you know, because like some of the podcasts I listen to, the bigger podcasts, when they go on these big tours and everything like that, and they're, you know, they've got hundreds of thousands of people all sitting there clapping and hooting when they come on stage. And I was thinking, if we ever got to that point, which of course it won't, it'll be like, it'll be four drunk men in sleepaway camp t-shirts sat around in some kind of cupboard somewhere. That's probably what we would attract. But Eric could do a stand-up, couldn't you? And you could do a compilation of all your jokes of the week.
Way to marginalize our fan base, Justin. Our fan base is four nerds in a cupboard somewhere.
Well, if you're one of those nerds, you know, drop us a line.
Yeah.
And the contact details will be coming up later. No, we know we have a very varied fan base, and we love you very much. Yeah. So,
Feedback. From Facebook, J.W. Durbin says, the eternal question is this Australian horror on par with houseboat horror? Only a lollipop-munching owl might know. Nice atmosphere fills the eerie mood. Something sorely needed for spooky house flicks. In my opinion, she should have left her mother's diary alone. Such disrespect. I enjoyed this movie, but it is a slow burn, as they say. So make sure you are in the right mood for it. Dane Damage Dregan says, this movie's awesome. Not in the colloquial sense. I feel awed by it.
There are shots in it that speak volumes without a word of dialogue. It's deliberately paced without dragging on. It's just one heck of a great flick. Dylan gravely says, great poster, great movie to fall asleep to. I don't know if he's being catty there or not. I don't know. Leah Cefalo says, one of my favorites. Zachary Paul Franklin says, I love this flick when I saw a VHS rip of it many years ago. I could tell how stylish it was despite the crappy resolution and blocky pixels. The slow-mo image of the tumbling sugar tower is a true highlight. And I forgot to mention that scene. That scene is fantastic where she's building that kind of house of cars out of sugar cubes. And it's building to something. It's just a great scene. Anyway, he says, Next to Kin is for sure a slow burn. I showed it to some friends and they couldn't get into it. Personally, I love the gothic atmosphere and dread that builds throughout. The big reveal still manages to pack a punch, and several set pieces are truly chilling. Amanda Reyes says Next of Kin just screened at the Austin Film Society earlier this year, and it's amazing. Very stylish and moody with a few really great oh my god moments. That scene where the protagonist sees her friend in the car as it drives away and you can just sort of tell she's had her throat slit is so freaky. Also, John Jarrett was a legit hunk. He was so hot in this and Picnic at Hanging Rock. I had a hard time believing it was the same guy from Wolf Creek. Anyway, I digress. I love Next of Kin. If memory serves, the AFS programmers said the filmmaker was inspired by the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but it's really its own beast, so unique. Joshua Grattan says, one of the creepiest films I've ever seen. It's so effective that it's almost a blessing that the deaths are all off screen. Interesting. Yeah, I would agree there, Josh. Patrick Hamilton says, I genuinely adore it. Ozploitation has the best third acts. Andrew F. Moncrief says, seen it twice. Rewatched day before yesterday. It's great. Can't say I understand the plot completely, but this movie is mostly about mood, visuals, and sound design, and Tony Williams directed the hell out of it. Blaine Geyser says, tense little forgotten gem. The last 30 or so minutes is where it really shines. The wheelchair gets me every time, and God, how did I not mention the wheelchair? Oh my God, that scene. Severin's Blu-ray release looks great as well. Overall, creepy little gem. Just reading some of this feedback, I'm just remembering little scenes in this film that I loved. It's a great movie. James Minge? James, I'll just call you James. James just picked this up and is planning to watch it soon. So good luck, James. Don't Look Behind You says, as far as Ozploitation is concerned, bottom of the list. Sure, it's stylish and moody, but equally plotting and nonsensical. I waited years to watch it, got the Severin release, and honestly was fairly disappointed. Sorry, Don't Look Behind You. On our forums, Tristan Comer says, not my favorite of the Australian slashers, but it's still a slow burn that has earned all of its praises and then some. From the bloody water fountain to John Jarrett's corpse coming at the heroine out of the darkness. The last half hour in particular stays seared in the memory. Tuzotonic says, I can finally stop complaining that you guys haven't covered this. To me, it is the best Australian slasher movie. Throughout the film, you get the feeling that something's off and not quite right. As in many Australian films, the atmosphere is excellent. Mr. Palmer says, I'd probably say it's my favorite Aussie slasher film, too. Like mentioned, the final half hour is fantastic. On Instagram, Arkham Sunset says, good atmosphere, though I don't think it was as interesting as Tarantino says. I'll forever associate this film with the old, with old dead and bloated men in bathtubs. Kind of like Eric's typical Saturday night. Well, maybe not dead, but bloated men in bathtubs is Eric's typical Saturday night.
I suppose.
You would agree there, wouldn't you? Yeah. Eugene Weaver says decent enough, but I was a bit bored with it and never understood the Shining comparison. Good Blu-ray release, though, from Umbrella. Is Umbrella the same as Severin?
No, Umbrella is Australian. So I think it's been released by Umbrella in the Australia, Severin in the US, and Second Sight in the UK and Ireland. So it's everywhere now.
Yeah, okay. Over on Twitter, Alone in the Dark Book says, unsung masterpiece. It's a shame the deleted scenes don't exist on film anymore. They would have made it even more of a slasher. Alan Dorich says, it's very slow. Apocalyptic level ending, though. DP Zach Voitos says, awesome. Joe for Jeff Productions says, a good one-watch movie. And finally, George Platts says, despite a couple of scenes, I fail to see what others see in it. That's all the feedback I have on. And it's kind of interesting because, like, Twitter, it's like seems like most of them just kind of like, eh. Same with Instagram, but everybody on Facebook and then the forums are just kind of gushing over it. So interesting divide there.
Hmm. Well, talking of gushing over it, Eric.
Guess who? Can you guess?
No.
Simon.
Oh, right.
And he says, out of the four of you, whose is the biggest? I imagine that Justin's at least used to be the biggest, but suspect he suffered significant shrinkage since his move to a warmer climate, maybe from spending all that time swimming in the ocean. The size of Nathan's has probably been affected by his regular partaking in a certain unnamed substance. I would presume that Eric's is a pretty sizable one, given how regularly he talks about adding to it, whereas Joseph seems to spend most of his time playing with other people's ones, including the baby Jesus's, instead of working on his own. I'm talking about your movie collections, of course.
Dole.
From Simon Logan. Oh, Simon, you had me thinking you were talking about Winkles.
Well, Eric took a very small...
collections, yes. I know you sold off a lot of your stuff when you did the move, Justin, so do you still have many?
I probably have about 300 or 400 Blu-rays and DVDs, I think, and I kept about four VHS. Obviously the Blu-rays and DVDs were easier to move, and of course the but I used to have about 300 or 400 VHS, but I sold most of those. I sold quite a lot of my movie memorabilia, but I still have a box of stuff, so I've kept a fair bit of that as well. How about yourself?
I have very few VHS left. I never really had any kind of rare or collectible VHS back in the day. So I only have a handful of VHS. I have tons of bloody Blu-rays and DVDs, though. DVDs you can't give away, really. There's only a few I'd sort of, you know, chuck away willingly. The rest of them I want to keep for my collection. But I have far too many, probably. Joseph?
Yeah, I pretty much got rid of my collection many years ago. I just, I think my enthusiasm for collecting movies kind of died when the video store died, because I always liked the hunt, going on the hunt for movies to try to buy from video stores. And I love Blu-rays. I love the special features, but it's just not the same for me. So I'm more of a movie memorabilia guy now. I don't really collect movies. I just watch the movies.
So, and obviously we can't, for Nathan, we'll have to check with him next time.
Yeah. Well, I've seen Nathan's collection. He still has a lot of Blu-rays and DVDs, so he's got a fairly big collection.
He's got a big one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're pretty much correct there, Simon. I think you were.
Yes.
I think you were on the right path there.
Is that all from Simon, or was it...
all from Simon, yes.
So it wasn't the start of a long one.
No.
Okay, well, shall I go next? I've got one here, which is quite a long one. So it says, hello, Podfathers, Jay here again. I hope this email finds you all happy and healthy. So I had back spinal surgery a little over a week ago, and my convalescence is going extremely well. But as you can imagine, I have lots of free time to watch movies. So to say, Jay, I hope you're still recovering well. He says, I've already done my own private film festivals, highlighting 70s horror, 80s slasher, and a Roger Corman exploitation fest, by struggling to decide what to focus on next. Then I listened to episode 188 featuring Delirium and Your Die at Midnight. Eureka! My next deep dive will be Jali. I've already lined up Torso, Forbidden Photos of a Lady Above Suspicion, Blood and Black Lace, still waiting for you all to cover that one. Tenebrae and Eyeball with your commentary, of course.
Look back into our archive. We covered it ages ago.
We're going to be covering that for, I think, episode 200, I think. I don't know. We'll see. But I'm currently watching The Case of the Bloody Iris, which, besides giving me my Edwidge Fenech fix, features one of my favourite Giallo scores ever. And I would very much agree with you there, Jay. Speaking of Giallo scores, have any of you ever seen or heard of the film Piercing? I caught it at Fantastic Fest last year, and I recently screened it again. The entire soundtrack is composed of music from old Giallo. I started grinning when I heard the first strains of music, and my grin lasted until the credits rolled to the music of Tenebrae. The movie is a really fun, twisty story as well. I feel like I've heard of Piercing, but Was it those Shadow of Your Tears, or whatever they were called, the French pseudo Jali from the last few years. They used tracks from existing Jali of the 1970s. Do you ever see any of those? It was all very bit style of substance.
I went to the cinema to see Strange Colour of Your Body's Tears.
That's the one, yeah.
And it was odd. It was more like an art installation, really, than a movie.
Yeah. We've spoken about those before, haven't we? We sort of said that they didn't really satisfy the Giallo, you know, the mystery, the kind of side of things at all. But Jay goes on and saying, closing, I love how you've been generously sharing promos from other podcasts on your show lately. So my co-host and I would like to humbly submit this promo for one of our shows. Have you seen this one? It seems only fitting, since you gents are the ones who inspired me to create our podcast in the first place. So thanks so much and keep up the great work. I can't wait to hear you all's talk on the Beyond. Your fan and friend Jay Bullington, producer and co-host of Have You Seen This One, aka Histo, or I don't know if it's but which stands for Have You Seen This One. So we'll check that out. Joseph, have you got the promo for that?
Yeah, actually, I played his promo in our last The High Tension episode. So we got that email a while back.
Okay. Well, I hope you're
right before I started editing the episode. So
I've just Googled Have You Seen This One's podcast, and their latest episode is on Chopping Mall, one of our favorites.
Excellent. Yeah. Good stuff. So, okay. Well, thank you, Jay. I hope you're recovering nicely and still enjoying your movies.
All I know is today's October the 31st. 31 backwards is 13. It's Friday. It's Halloween.
It's the 13th anniversary of the lawnmower killings. It's a crazy loose. It's prom night.
Hi, this is Tracy Savage, Debbie from Friday the 13th, Part 3. For the best podcast ever on old slasher movies, be sure you find Hysteria Continues. You will be glad you did. And hey, stay out of Crystal Lake, okay?
Every episode, we celebrate a classic slasher movie, such as Friday the 13th, Halloween, My Bloody Valentine, Happy Birthday to Me, and Crazy Fat Ethel 2. The Hysteria Continues, bringing slash with panache since 2011. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and all good podcatchers.
Hello, Headites. While Brandon goes to write down some more puns that Christian will threaten to leave the show over, and Dave goes to look for more red lights for that room of his that clearly doubles as a European whorehouse, please allow me to tell you about another great horror podcast, In the Mic of Madness. We also have what most shows only talk about, tits, real ones, on a real girl, and we call her Becca. She even knows some shit about movies. My other co-host, Brad, sometimes can get so loose with his lips that it's left on the cutting room floor due to the cease and desist orders. I will warn you up front that our show is not for the faint of heart. We speak fast and loose with our words and tend to offend as much as we entertain. We grew up in far less sensitive times, and our banter reflects that. We focus mainly on ultra-low-budget cinema that most people either ignore or pirate. We also interview filmmakers and actors you've never heard of and get them to say stuff they'll probably regret once you have heard of them. So come on over and join the fun at In the Mic of Madness, where overlooked films get their fair shake.
Thank you for everyone who's written in. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. So keep on doing so. And we'll be announcing at the end of the show, which is rapidly approaching, what our next pick will be. And again, also would like to say a big thank you to all our Patreon supporters. We're just about to record our top three pre-1970 horror movies, which you can listen to exclusively if you are a patron of the show, which you can do for as little as $1 a month. And it helps keep the show on the air. And also you get access to all the shows early. So again, thank you very, very much to everyone who's done so.
I would just like to say thanks to we've had a couple of new Patreon subscribers, and they've been a little generous. A couple of them have been a little generous, so thank you very much.
Okay.
I want to thank them with something that we've neglected to play on this podcast yet, and that's this. I can't believe the podcast was nearly over and I hadn't played it.
I've got this mental image of the Patreon, the kind of thing, like dropping quickly.
It's dropping as we speak.
into minus figures. We're going to start being fined.
We owe them. We owe. Yeah.
So, yes, well, thank you. So what are we covering next time? It's Nathan's pick next time, isn't it?
We're going to cover Cannibal Campout. It's a shot on video movie.
Thanks, Nathan.
Yeah, thank you, Nathan. Yeah, so from one extreme Nathan's to another.
Cannibal Campout. It's a late 80s, or I think it's late 80s shot on video. Definitely a Nathan pick, so buckle up.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Well, it'll give us a chance to talk about late 80s shot on video flicks as well. So, but again, from the sublime to the ridiculous, quite literally. Yeah. So what are we playing out with, Joseph?
I don't know. It's going to be a while before I edit this, so do you guys have any ideas? I just I don't know.
I know what Justin would have played out with if this was his pick.
What was that then?
What's that?
Susie and the Banshees cover version of This Wheel's on Fire, because it has next of kin in the lyrics.
Ah.
Oh, This Wheel's on Fire in the wheelchair. Yeah, it's a good idea.
There you go. Well, there's a fire at the end when the the gas station explodes.
Oh, that's good.
Eric, you put a little too much thought into this, considering how much you dislike Susie.
Mm. You could play the classic song from Houseboat Horror again, since it's Australia.
Young,
groovy.
Ooh. No.
Actually, funny enough, if you look on IMDb for Next of Kin, there's the Patrick Swayze movie as well.
Yeah.
And it's actually got, I think it's actually got the trailer from this Next of Kin on that Swayze film, so all slightly mixed up. But anyway, so well, thank you for listening to The Hysteria Continues, and we look forward to going on a Cannibal Campout next time.
We look forward to it, really.
So join us on that one, and with the return of Nathan with a vengeance. So say goodbye to the good people.
Bye.
Arrivederci.
Bye.
I'm cool, she's hot. Can't put my finger on just what she's got. And late at night, I'm drinking beer. I'd like to take it far away from here. This little shoe's gonna steal my heart. And if I don't